How do you get them to do that?
You told me that.
How can I make it much more, because the life is rotating. How can you just make it more?
Well, how to be inspired generally is a very, very hard question, especially, you know, in fact, this is a problem that everyone has. You do mitzvahs, you tend to do the same mitzvahs all the time, you daven the same words all the time. How do you keep them fresh? How do you keep them vibrant? You know, King David says in the Psalms that there is one thing I ask of God, to dwell in the house of God all the days of my life and to visit his temple. So people ask the question, does he want to dwell or does he want to visit? Those are two different things. Dwell is you live there. Visit is to visit. And the Hasidic books explain that King David is saying he wants to be connected to God all the time, but he wants to have the same excitement as the first time that he visited. Tefillin is a very good example. You know, for some of you guys, this might be relatively new in putting on tefillin, but, you know, for some of us, we've been wearing tefillin for many, many years. But the first time a bar mitzvah boy puts on tefillin, it is such an excitement, such a geschmack, as we say, such a wonderful feeling. After a while, it becomes routine. King David is praying that though I stay with God all of my life, it should be as fresh as a visit. Now, the truth of the matter is, the same way that you pray for health and you pray for making a living and you pray for all sorts of physical things, you pray that God should give you inspiration, God should give you strength. Part of how you remain inspired is by prayer, but number two, by learning to notice things in the world, by learning to cultivate a personality of gratitude, by looking at your life, by appreciating the blessings that Hashem has given you. And every day you realize, I wake up in the morning, my eyes are open, I'm able to go to the bathroom, I am able to walk, I'm able to talk. These are miracles. These are not things you can take for granted. There are people in the world who don't have these blessings. And the more you notice, in fact, the word for gratitude in Hebrew is a wonderful word. Hakaras hatov does not mean to be grateful, literally. It means to recognize that you've received good. Our real problem in life is we go through life oblivious. We don't even recognize the things that are going on. And if we can learn to notice things, that could change a person's whole perspective. I think I may have mentioned to you guys the other day, Rabbi Avigdor Miller was a great, great teacher who emphasized gratitude and the like. I told you the story that he put his head in the sink. The story basically was that somebody told him the air wasn't good that day and it took away some of his gratitude for breathing. So he stuck his head underwater for a few seconds to feel what it's like to suffocate. And then he said, you know, the air isn't as bad as I thought. So this is a lifelong process. But, you know, to be grateful for life turns into loving Hashem. When you love Hashem, you then have more faith in Him. You depend in Him. And you know that life is not going to be easy. Emunah does not mean everything will turn out exactly the way I want it. Emunah means everything will turn out exactly the way He wants it. And that'll be for my good, even if I don't see it in the short run. But there are some books. There's a wonderful book by Rav Arush of Breslov, Garden of Faith, which talks about this in a very practical way. I would recommend it to people.
In Egypt, when the plagues were coming of the frogs, how come when they kept hitting the frogs and they kept multiplying, how come they didn't get the message after that?
Well, you're gonna have to ask the Egyptians. But you know, this is human nature. I'm not gonna tell you we're so much better than them. The truth of the matter is, part of the lesson is, God can hit you over the head a million times with the same message. And, you know, if you don't want to accept it, you don't accept it. Each person always says, well, maybe the next time it's not going to work. And this is the Yetzer Hara within a person that just refuses and refuses and refuses to acknowledge the hand of God. And the Torah likes to make this point, because the Torah likes to make the point that even miracles don't really change you. People often say, if only there would be a miracle, I would believe in the Almighty. So first of all, let's imagine that tomorrow morning the Red Sea splits. Well, there would be a geologist from MIT and Caltech that would give an explanation for it somehow, no matter what happens. You know, I'm sure you've heard of the Bible codes, and again, I don't want to put a lot into them, but that's the idea of messages being encoded. Again, scientifically, there's some problems, but there's a fellow, Michael Drassen, who really believes in this a lot. The problem is he's an atheist. So he has what you call cognitive dissonance, because on one hand he says it's impossible to have this encoding unless there's some supreme intelligence, but I don't believe in God. So he resolves it by saying there must be these super intelligent aliens who seeded the earth with the language of the Chumash. Now, what you see is, here you have a guy who's almost inevitably led to a certain conclusion that he doesn't want to accept. He's willing to make up the most far-fetched explanations instead of adopting the obvious one. You know, there's an old saying, when you hear hoofs marching behind you and you're not sure, you assume it's a horse instead of a zebra. It might be a zebra, but it's unlikely. You know, maybe Israel's different. I don't know, Africa. But certainly in the United States, if I hear hoofs, it's going to be a horse. And God's presence can be very, very obvious. But we'll make up every possible explanation. And that's an important lesson. Yeah.
I have a question here. At the incident of, or maybe incident's the wrong word, but I'll just continue. At the incident of Mount Sinai, where God spoke to the Jewish people, how do we know that the speaker was God and not a person or being with technology or knowledge that was a bit beyond the time?
Like the Wizard of Oz, or like the guy behind the curtain.
Some kind of display.
Well, you know, that is a good question, because one might imagine some super amazing technology. In a more mystical vein, now perhaps I can't give you 100% rational explanation. I mean, you know, you've heard the Khuzari's famous idea that Judaism is the only religion that makes a claim that an experience of revelation happened to 3 million people. And how do you make that up? Right, it can't be made up. I could make up a story that God spoke to me. I'm sorry.
The point of the question.
No, I understand the point of the question. Please, I understand the point of the question. I do. I really do. Okay. So I know that you understand that. But what the gentleman was trying to correct me in, which I understood all along, is that I understand that the 3 million merely proves that God spoke. I'm sorry, that there was a communication, but it does not prove automatically it was God, because 3 million people, right, did I get the point? Yeah, 3 million people might have heard some magnification or the like. So mystically, the concept would be this. You have the same question, really, with any prophet, and that is, how does a prophet know that God is talking to him, right? Every year, we have people who hear voices and who kill their children, and may claim that somebody spoke to them or whatever it is. But I mean, the short answer has to be in a deep mystical way, that number one, three million people don't go crazy, but number two, since our souls come from God, that's the theological belief ultimately, apparently there is an internal recognition system when God is speaking to you. In other words, it isn't just the loud voice, it isn't just the smoke, it isn't just the lightning, it isn't just the sound effects. Those could be simulated, those could be faked, and indeed Maimonides writes that one cannot have any proof of divinity from miracles and everything else. But there is the notion of internal intuitive recognition. Now, this presupposes you believe in God. Now I understand. Now, believing in God does not automatically mean God gave us the Torah. But if you believe in God, forget about Torah for a moment, you believe in God, then it might be logical to assert that the human soul, which comes from God, would recognize its own. Just as, for example, the body has an autoimmune system that rejects that which is outside of the body. Right, if you try to do an organ transplant or whatever it is, that's always a problem, and recognizes that which is in the body. So if you believe in God, now this presupposes that you accept that, then one might assert that there's an internal recognition of what is intrinsic to my essence and what is extrinsic to my essence. And even if, and then the Khuzari's argument does come in useful here, because even if individuals on a one-to-one basis can sometimes be misled and distorted by their yetzer hara, such as the people who hear voices, but that type of internal recognition is not falsifiable on that scale. In other words, we're adding something to the Kuzri here. In other words, the Kuzri's point is that the story of the lightning and the thunder could not have been fabricated. Granted, that doesn't answer your question directly. But I'm adding as a dimension to that, that there's a certain internal recognition that he who is created from God recognizes the authentic presence of God. And while that is not fail-safe on 100% level with respect to individuals, with respect to an entire nation, that is a fairly safe and secure indicator.
Is it fair to use an argument, though, that presupposes belief in the, or presupposes that this already exists to explain how we know it exists?
Well, okay. I mean, again, this is not the proof for God, as I say. This argument does presuppose a belief in God, and the question is simply, was God the source of the communication? Right. That's your particular question, which is a one question below the ultimate question. So here, as I say, I cannot prove this proposition directly, but I think it is logical to assume that like recognizes like. Right, you have a process in the universe. In fact, even gravity is based on some principle of things that are matter. Matter attracts matter. There is attraction. And since the soul is made from God and is of the essence of God in some ways, the soul has a natural attraction to the truth of godliness. There is an attraction of the soul. The soul, as it were, yearns to be united with its source. And that gives the capacity of internal recognition of an encounter with God. Now, this is something that even on our level, which is not such a saintly level, we occasionally have moments where we perceive that, right? We perceive that type of connection and the like. So at least it's something to think about. Once again, the question becomes, I understand the individual pathology, such as the guy that thinks he hears the voice of God. The question is, do you attribute pathology at such a wide level? Now, in terms of simply being fooled, I would just suggest that that when there is an encounter with something that purports to be God, we actually have a certain amount of internal systems that can separate the authentic from the fake. And over a large population, that will be a fairly accurate indicator.
Going back to that experience in Mount Sinai, isn't it written that we saw the voice of God, or was it something else?
Yeah, it says we saw. Yeah, that's right. A very unusual phrase.
So
we saw the voice.
You know, you don't see the voice.
Yeah.
You know, so for it to be another being or aliens or something like that, how can it really?
Something
else. I mean,
I understand. I mean, the problem ultimately is that, there are so many miraculous things happening, so many miraculous things. The question becomes, if you keep on positing, advanced technology, so eventually you could say, well, they could do anything. You know, who knows what magic, some Steven Spielberg in the next galaxy, is able to do. So, I mean, that's always the problem. I mean, it's obviously the miracles themselves carry a great deal of weight, but they're not dispositive. Yeah.
We're given many rules by God to follow, and sometimes they conflict. For example, you're committed to follow Shabbat, but on Shabbat you could perform a bris. How do we know which ones to follow and which ones to not follow?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The notion of prioritization of duties when they conflict is always a very, very difficult one. In fact, in all ethical systems, that's the most difficult, in medical ethics. When do you keep people alive if you cause them pain? When do you spare them pain by not prolonging their life and the like? The oral law, particularly discussions in the Talmud, spend many pages discussing precisely these issues. Usually there is some scriptural derivation in the text of the written law that indicates what takes priority. For example, in the case of circumcision, the Torah repeats several times, you shall circumcise on the eighth day, and there's no need to repeat it twice. And the repetition is said to teach us, no matter what the circumstances, you do it on the eighth day, even though it's
Shabbos.
Well, okay, so I'll tell you, the governing principle is actually a fascinating principle that you might think is counterintuitive. It basically says, when you have a conflict between thou shalt do and thou shalt not do, the thou shalt do overrides the thou shalt not do. The positive overrides the negative. And that is a general principle in Jewish law. The positives override, think positive, right? The positives override the negatives. And part of that is Nachmanides gives a beautiful logical reason for it. He says that positives express the relationship of love. When you love somebody, you serve God in a or anybody, you do things in a positive way for them. Negative represent fear, right? I don't dare cross your threshold. And since love of God is a higher emotion than fear of God, the mitzvos of love override the mitzvos of fear. Now, again, in any particular question, you should talk to a rabbi or a halachic scholar, because there are many, many exceptions to this. But the general rule is that the positives do override the negatives.
And if you have two positives and two negatives, it would be the higher source, like it's in the Ten Commandments, one's in the Torah, you do the one in the Ten Commandments.
Well, as a general rule, if you really had positive versus positive or negative versus... Well, negative versus negative is a little easier. There, you simply don't do anything, meaning to say... No, there is a concept of passivity, meaning you're at a standstill, you don't know where to move. Now, that's going to be a little more difficult, positive versus positive, because you've got to do something. It's a little more difficult to figure out a positive here and a positive here. It's no solution to do nothing, because then I'm transgressing both. So there might be different rules. The Ten Commandments does not have a special priority here, but certain commandments that help many people may be more significant than commandments that only help a limited number of people. I'll give you a good example of this. Of course, this may raise a difficult question, and that is, the Gemara has a story about a great rabbi who came to shul with his slave, and there's only 9 people and the slave doesn't count for a minyan. So he actually freed his slave, which was a loss of a big investment, in order to make him part of the minyan. And the Talmud says you're not supposed to free your slaves. They're supposed to remain as your slave. How is he allowed to transgress that? Now, I understand that raises a problem in and of itself, but the Talmud says that even though it's normally sinful to free your slave, but since this was a mitzvah that enabled Jews to daven with a minyan, that mitzvah overrides that mitzvah. So that's an example of one overriding another. Those are two... So there are all sorts of rules. And again, some of them are, some cases are difficult. To this very day, we are going to have responsa that talk about conflicting obligations, conflicting responsibilities. How do you balance them? That's one of the major questions.
But isn't it simple to have slaves in general? Isn't it simple to have slaves in general?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. It actually is not sinful to have slaves. The Torah does recognize the institution of slavery, but the type of slavery it envisions is vastly, vastly different from the conventional understanding of slavery. The Torah recognizes that a slave cannot be abused, a slave cannot be given work that is not dignified. So, for example, if my slave had training as an accountant, he becomes my bookkeeper. He does not become my janitor or garbage collector or the like. Moreover, a slave, a non-Jewish slave here, is obligated. You know, as he keeps Shabbos, for example. He does not do work on Shabbos. He has Shabbos off, just like a Jew would have and the like. Now, the question that you're raising is a good question, and that is, is the Torah encouraging slavery, or is the Torah tolerating slavery? In other words, one way of viewing the institution is that slavery in the ancient world was a given, and the Torah couldn't order us to go cold turkey, because that would have been something that...
Why not?
Well, because people have a Yetzer Hara. They sometimes don't accept radical breaks. For example, Maimonides says that by sacrifices. Maimonides says, not everybody agrees with him, that God does not desire animal sacrifices, but people who were attached to paganism, that's the Jewish people, were so connected to sacrifice, including human sacrifices, that if God would have told them, forget it, they wouldn't have been able to break away. So God gives them a way of incorporating that in divine worship, with the intent of getting them away from paganism and human sacrifices. Now, some commentaries view slavery in the same light. It did exist, and in the world, slaves were abused, slaves were tortured, slaves were murdered. God said, all right, I'll let you have it, but you got to treat your slaves with dignity and kindness. But the ultimate goal would be the abolition of it. That is one way of looking at it, that slavery is tolerated, not encouraged per se. There is another way of looking at it, though, is that slavery was was something that God considered to be desirable. Why would that be so is a bit of a problem, but in some way it was thought of a kind of a mechanism of civilizing the ancient Canaanites when the Jews conquered the land of Israel, to bring them to the worship of God, to bring them to mitzvot in various ways.
That sounds like a Catholic idea. There's savages, let's go enslave the savages and teach them Jesus.
The fact that the Catholics say it also, that doesn't mean it's automatically incorrect. But there is such a concept that the laws of slavery were mechanisms of civilizing. Now, the British tried that in Africa as well, not just Catholics. It's similar to colonialization generally. But there are two views. So, I mean, you're free. You're free to think whatever you want. But, you know, there are thinkers. There are thinkers within our tradition who view slavery as a tolerated institution, but not an ultimately desirable institution. Another example of that is polygamy. Now, you may know that in biblical and even Talmudical times, male polygamy was permitted. And in fact, Jacob, of course, we know, had two wives, two concubines, really four wives. Avraham had two wives, or at least one wife and one concubine, and the like. And yet, but it's not just the great Avos that had it. I mean, according to the Gemara, the Bible and the Talmud, anybody who wanted could have multiple wives. That was permitted. There's a limit of no more than 18, etc. After that. Now, the thing is, polygamy became prohibited for Ashkenazic Jews relatively late, not until the 11th century, the 1000s. By the edict of Rabbeinu Gershom, who was the leader of German Jewry, and Ashkenazim accepted his role. Sephardim, until very recently, were actually practicing polygamy. There were Yemenites and the like, and although the state of Israel outlawed it, but there was a grandfather clause. In other words, an old Yemenite who came with more than one wife was permitted. I think they're all died out now, and the like. But once again, the question becomes, putting the patriarch example aside, was polygamy a tolerated institution, or was it a desirable institution? Clearly, there are problems in considering it desirable, because the beginning of the Bible, when it talks about the creation of Adam and Eve, it says, "Therefore shall a man leave his mother and father, and cleave unto his wife, and be one flesh." That doesn't sound so consistent with the notion of multiple sexual partners.
So it says in the singular term.
Yes. So some thinkers have suggested that the Torah permitted certain institutions that would have been difficult to uproot, but the ultimate morality would lead us into a further direction. Again, this is a big, big argument, whether the Torah sometimes speaks in transitional levels. Rav Kook, the great first chief rabbi of, not of the state of Israel, because he died before there was a state, but of the of Israel, of Palestine, as it was called then, actually made a very similar argument regarding vegetarianism. Now, he was not a vegetarian, contrary to what you might read, but he basically said that as we approach the Messianic era, and as we increase in our reverence for all forms of life, in the days of Mashiach, we will be vegetarian, because we will have respect and reverence for all of life. Now, Rav Kook cautioned, we're not there yet, because we haven't achieved the basic decency in human relations. And you don't go to these higher levels till you've achieved a certain sequence. But once again, he sees the heter, the dispensation of meat, as a concession to human weakness, to give us outlets for our aggressiveness, so to speak, so that we should displace it from human beings. So this notion of mitzvos as potential transitional states is a very, very intriguing idea, but it does raise some concerns.
So I have two questions. One is regarding the Brit Milah on Shabbat. Aren't they both positive commandments, because it's so clear Shabbat teaches that language?
Excellent, excellent question.
And
so it's, yeah.
Another question. So regarding things that like may not apply to this, just slavery, sacrifice, etc. Can't this be applied to like other ideas that have been like accepted widely in the mainstream, such as Torah's attitude toward homosexuality?
Okay, so let me answer the second question first, because you're correct. I opened up a big, big can of worms by what I said, and it could potentially lead to a lot of misunderstanding. And that is, if you look at the Torah as kind of transitional morality, you got a real, real problem with, whoa, so this could change, and that could change, and that could change, and then the whole structure doesn't have to be immutable. So I think you have to draw a very clear distinction. You have to draw a very clear distinction between what the Torah permits and what the Torah forbids. And that is the following. The Torah doesn't say you have to have a slave. The Torah allows you to have a slave. The Torah doesn't say you have to have a lot of wives. The Torah allows you. So in the context of when the Torah allows you to do things, we could really say, maybe God doesn't really want me to do those things, but he allows them because maybe even at that time of history, it would have been too difficult to have a cold break. So God allows me gradualism in terms of reaching a higher level of morality. But, and I'm glad you brought it up because I'm sorry if I created some misunderstanding. When God says, not that you're allowed to do something, but when God says, I don't want you to do it, we regard those commands as eternal, as immutable, and unchanging, even if we don't fully understand them. The issue of gay rights from a liberal perspective, it's sometimes hard for us to understand, you know, why should we care, etc. And yet, if God gave us these commandments, we cannot change them. So one has to be very careful that this argument of the introduction of possible evolutionary morality, which could be a real, real Pandora's box, only refers to those areas which are permitted, which are discretionary. They do not refer to the areas of mandatory.
Carbonate or commandments are not like permitted. It's not like you're allowed to do carbonate. It's like you have to get carbonate at this time, and you have to no longer do it to change it.
Well, you know, it depends. There is a daily ritual of carbonate, which is mandatory, and if a person commits certain sins, he needs to bring the carbonos. But there's a whole panoply of korbanos that are voluntary that a person could decide I want to bring or not to bring. So there is a certain amount of discretion built in. But in terms of the korbanos that are mandatory themselves, do you have that problem? Well, you know, it is a problem in Maimonides. I'm going to admit that. And, you know, Maimonides' position about korbanot as being concessions to human weakness, as I indicated, it has been attacked by many, including Nachmanides. And Nachmanides has a whole different take on it. He says korbanos are not about concessions to our desire to have human sacrifices. He says korbanos are about symbolically affecting us. In other words, the concept is the real korban is the repentance and the submission you bring to God, but the symbolic action of the animal giving its life makes you recognize there but for the grace of God goes I, and it's part of a symbolic transformation of a worshiper. That is why, by the way, when the prophets always criticize the Jews for insincere korbanos, because they basically say there are two ways you can look at a korban. You can look at a korban as a bribe to a deity. I pay you off like protection money. Or you can look at a korban as a vehicle of transformation and humility. And if you don't change your life as a result of your korban, you go out, bring your korban, and you go out and you steal and you cheat, then all you're doing is you're looking at a korban as paying off God as a bribe. Not only is that not a mitzvah, that becomes very, very sinful. You know, so according to Ramban, the whole point of a korban is a trigger to change you. Now, you asked your first question about Shabbat, which is a very good question, that circumcision versus Shabbat is not just a positive against a negative. Shabbos has a positive as well. And you're correct. I oversimplified a little bit. That is why Bris Milah is not covered by the general rule of positive overrides negative. That is why there's a special scriptural derivation beyond the general rule to elevate Milah even beyond that point. In other words, it's subsumed in the general only by virtue of a special pasuk. Without that special pasuk, you would not have covered it by the general rule. You're 100% correct.
I understand there's a either understanding or a tradition that in the Torah there's no extra words, there's no, like, not enough words. Every word is said as it is for a specific purpose. How come the Torah says, I am your God, and thou shalt not have any other gods before me, as opposed to there are no other gods?
In other words, why the emphasis, thou shalt not have any other gods,
right,
as opposed to... that's an excellent question. And once again, you know, Rabbi Schiller mentioned on Shabbos the difference between prose and poetry. We had a little bit of a literature discussion. And one of the distinctions, which is not the particular one that he mentioned, is that poetry can have many, many nuances that go beyond the explicit. There can be primary messages, secondary messages, tertiary messages, and the like. Torah is called a poem. The whole Torah is called a poem, not because it rhymes, not because it has meter, but because there are infinite levels of meaning. On the simplest level, you're 100% correct. Thou shalt not have any other gods is really, there are no other gods. But there are other meanings to that verse, and it's really directing itself to the human condition. Place nothing in your life. It's not a statement of theology. It's a statement of actualization in your life. Put nothing in your life above the worship of God. Not your money, not your profession, not your dignity, not your honor, not love of family or country. Thou shalt not have any other gods, small g. Those other gods could be anything. Right, political systems, my faith in communism, my faith in democracy, etc. So it's making a very powerful statement that because I am the God that took you out of Egypt and you became my servants and you became obligated to serve me, there is nothing in your life that can be your God other than the service of God. So your formulation would have been the theological point, but this is making the point of my value system and the core of my existence. Over there. So that's fascinating. This is an argument between Maimonides and Nachmanides, two of the greatest thinkers. Maimonides says, the first of the Ten Commandments, actually in Hebrew, by the way, Ten Commandments, the phrase is not commandments. Aseres Hadibros means the Ten Statements. So it doesn't even call it commandments, but we translate, you know, we say commandments. But what's the first one? I am the Lord your God, who took you out of Egypt from the house of slavery. Is that a commandment or is that a statement? It seems to be a statement, a fact. But Maimonides says it is a commandment to believe in God. Nachmanides says that makes no sense. What does it mean, a commandment to believe in God? If I don't believe in God, who's given me the commandment? If I go over to an atheist who says, I don't believe in God, and I tell the atheist, you must believe in God. And the atheist says, why? And I say, because God said so. The atheist's answer is going to be, I don't believe in God. There's no God that's telling me. So Nachmanides takes the position of your question that there is no such thing as a commandment to believe in God, but belief in God is a foundational predicate for everything else. Now, linguistically, that fits the Ten Commandments, because Anochi, I am the Lord your God, is not phrased as thou shalt do or thou shalt not do. It is a statement from which different commandments emanate. That is Nachmanides' position. But what is Maimonides' position? Maimonides actually counts it as a mitzvah of emunah. So the way Maimonides' position is explained is, God is not talking to an atheist, because an atheist is not going to listen to that yet. God is talking to a believer. But God is saying, you who believe in God because you were taught this way, you were raised this way, this was your tradition, this was your family background, I'm telling you, You are now supposed to try to delve into this rationally so that you could be convinced, not just as a matter of blind faith, but be convinced rationally in the existence of God. So according to Maimonides, now this has a controversial philosophical history. According to Maimonides, the mitzvah of Emunah is specifically to move away from blind faith and ground your faith in rationality. Maimonides wrote The Guide to the Perplexed, one of his very famous works in Arabic, to try to reconcile Aristotelian philosophy, which was the philosophy of the Middle Ages, with religious revelation, and to try to lay the intellectual foundation for the existence of God. Now, I call that very controversial because there were many, many great rabbis who took exactly the opposite view. They said that one is not supposed to try to deal with this in a totally rational way. Emunah requires a leap of faith. It requires putting your faith in something even if you cannot prove it with definitiveness. So this is a great, great argument that lasts to this very day, and it's based on an argument between two of the greatest medieval rabbis, Ramban, Nachmanides, and Maimonides. What did you say?
So back to Revelation for a moment. So the revelation happens at Sinai, and then Moses goes up and receives the Ten Commandments, comes down with them. Does God reveal himself again when he goes to write the second set of commandments and comes down with a different set?
Well, that's a very excellent question. As you know, the Ten Commandments appears in two different places in the Torah, in Exodus and Deuteronomy.
But it mentions in the Exodus of Kisisa that
The question becomes whether the differences in Exodus and Deuteronomy, do they correspond to the first and the second? Not everyone learns that way. In other words, many commentaries learn that what he got in the second was exactly the same as what he got in the first, and there were no changes. And the question you might ask quite legitimately is, so what took him 40 days? In other words, it was 40 days the first time. And then he gets back for another 40 days. He gets the same thing. Like, what exactly took, 40 days of doing? One of the interpretations, interestingly enough, is that although he got the same written text, but the second 40 days was essentially the revelation of the processes of the oral law, that the oral law itself was a product of that revelation of the second 40 days. So, yes, God did appear to him, and God spoke to him, and there was a revelation. It was the same written Torah text, but the revelation of the oral law was granted there. Now, you might say, well, that raises an interesting counterfactual hypothetical. That is, well, what does that mean? If we wouldn't have sinned with the golden calf, there wouldn't have been an oral law?
Question that I see as struggle is in Parshas Yisro is Yisro suggests don't teach everyone the whole Torah, teach it to a few people and let them pass it down.
Yeah.
Because if you teach everyone at once, you're going to tire yourself out. So
yeah.
By having a more focused teaching, he's able to relay the idea of Torah and oral law and let it trickle down from there.
Well, maybe I have a slightly different understanding, because it seems to me, if I remember, that the problem that Yisro was raising was not so much the problem of Moshe as teacher, it was the problem of Moshe as judge. In other words, the issue was people, Reuven was suing Shimon for making too much noise at night, and Yisro was just concerned that if Moshe is adjudicating controversies from morning until night, he's going to be worn out and will not be able to lead the people and give them spiritual guidance.
But they need to know the law to be able to make those judgments.
No, that's correct. But the question, the question really becomes: what would have been the alternative to the oral law? What would have existed? And one of the suggestions is that there would have been much more of the involvement of prophecy, meaning the oral law is essentially kind of the rules of interpretation and logic and thinking and of extrapolation that requires us to be actively involved in the implementation of Torah. And it was said that had we not sinned with the golden calf, we just would have had kind of prophecy guiding us without having to go through the rigorous participation of the logical processes. In other words, it would have been a different form of spiritual analysis. It would have been a more spiritualized activity, a less intellectual activity. The oral law requires our intellectual input. So that's an interesting process. Yeah.
Okay, Rabbi, can I just...
I'm sorry.
I'm kind of stuck in a weird situation back home. I go to a certain shul, and there's a certain Hasidic rabbi that asked me to do something that made me feel kind of uncomfortable. I work with parking tickets, citations, and one day he called me out of the blue, and he says, "Hey, Fabian, I have a question for you. A couple of the people in the minion, they came to shul, and they got a couple parking tickets. Is there something that you can do to make this disappear?" Now, the thing with me, I want to help out a fellow Jew,
yes,
especially a rabbi, and it hit me that that's unethical and immoral, what he's asking me to do, because it's going to constitute me to pretty much lie or make something disappear, which in reality... they're at fault for receiving the tickets for whatever reason it was that they got. Whether we agree with them or not, they did something.
Okay.
Now, I told the rabbi the first time, because he asked me three separate times, I'll see what I can do. I'll try my best. So what I did is I took them and I paid for them out of my own pocket.
Ooh.
Yeah, to do a mitzvah. He didn't know I paid for them. He just knew I took care of them. And it was like 2-3 tickets, separate ones.
Yeah.
And that was that. He thanked me, and that was that. A couple months later, he calls me, does the same thing. At this time, I'm like, is he trying to take advantage, or like, I just felt very that it was wrong. So I told him I didn't want to offend the rabbi or call him out on it. But I told him, look, rabbi, I'm gonna be honest with you. I'll see what I can do, but I can't promise anything. And most likely, I won't be able to do anything. So I gave it 1 or 2 days. I call him back and I say, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, I can't do it. I'm so sorry. He calls me again and does it again several months later. And I started thinking, well, look, I want to do a mitzvah. So I have two questions with this situation. One, what should I do? And two, would Hashem allow me to commit a sin in order to help someone out and do a mitzvah?
Well, you know, I think you've handled it absolutely correctly, and I just want to defend the rabbi a little bit. The rabbi is basically wrong. We could say that, but sometimes people don't have a full understanding of the legal process. In other words, sometimes a person might honestly think that there are ways you can legitimately take care of this, maybe by offering an explanation, maybe by saying, you know, the rabbi's an honest guy.
Okay.
Or whatever. So it's you don't have to look at it that he was asking you to do something illegal.
Okay.
He was, but he may not have known that.
Okay.
So that's one way of looking at it from the rabbi's perspective. In terms of your own perspective, you know, you are correct. You know, there is a principle that says the law of the land is, this is a halakhic principle, the law of the land is the law, that we are obligated to pay the taxes and fines that the duly elected government imposes on us. And if I evade those obligations, I'm not only violating a law, I'm violating God's law as well. The law of the land is the law. So, sure, I would tell you very much not to be involved in anything that's dishonest. But that would be true even if you wouldn't be caught. Let me add, there's another dimension. When you get caught in these matters, you are what is called desecrating God's name. People will know if you're a Jew. Hey, you're a Jew who's fixing tickets for rabbis.
Yeah.
And the New York Times will run, the Forward will run a thing about how rabbis try to fix parking tickets or whatever you have in San Diego. And the worst thing a Jew can do is to drag the Jewish people and the Torah into the mud. So you're put in a very, very difficult situation. I sympathize with you, but I think you did the right thing.
Now, would it be
thing.
Bad for me to let him know how I feel, or I should just withdraw
from that? I think you ought to tell him.
Okay.
Especially if the rabbi might not realize that this is illegal. He might just think it's something you can...
And my second question, real quick from that, what is Hashem's view on me committing a sin to do a mitzvah?
Well, you can't do it.
I can't do it.
You can't, unless you have the priority rules, like the positive over.
Like Robin Hood, for example.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, there's a principle in Jewish law that talks about a mitzvah that is done through a snavera. That means a mitzvah that you do through a sin. I steal a lulav to use it on sukkahs, right?
Yeah.
Not only is it a sin, but I don't get the mitzvah either. I get a sin, I don't get a mitzvah.
Okay.
Because God does not want to be served by immoral and dishonest means. So by all means, you need to be very honest. And this is true for everything. This is true for taxes. This is true for people sometimes fill out fraudulent insurance forms. It's a problem, you know. So, and sometimes the HR is very strong because, you know, you're short of money, you need the money. Here in Israel, you know, everybody is short of money, etc. And you figure out the government has plenty of it and the like. You know, so I understand the feeling. I understand the feeling. And I don't want to look negatively at people who sometimes have difficulties making ends meet. But if you're asking me objectively how you behave with honesty. And that's what Hashem wants you to do. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'll get to you. Yeah.
What's the deal with military service in Israel? And if everybody goes to a yeshiva, how big should the army be?
Whoa. Well, this is
not
the,
making any judgment.
This is the issue of the day, right? We have the Plesser Commission, which happens to be headed by an Orthodox person, kind of strangely enough. I just read an interview with him, and he says, "You can't accuse me of not caring about Torah. I just came here from my daf yomi shir, the shir, the davin, etc." And I'm not going to give you my opinion. I'm just going to lay out the basic parameters, which you probably could articulate yourself. On one hand, you know, Israel needs an army. We're faced with hostile forces who want to destroy us. When you're a member of the Israeli army, you're putting your life at risk for your country and for your fellow Jews. And all of us have to be very, very grateful for those great sacrifices. If you remember in the Chumash itself, when the two tribes of Reuven and Gad wanted to settle on the east bank of the Jordan, and they went to Moshe and said, "Let's stay here, we want to live here." Moshe said to them, "Your brothers are going to war, and you want to stay here? No, you go and fight with the rest of the people, and then you come back." I mean, that's what it says in the Chumash. As somebody said, that pasuk was not made up by the left wing. I mean, that's in the Chumash directly. So there is a strong argument that military service ought to be shared in a more equal way. But you got to look at the other side. There are other sides here that are very, very powerful. First of all, the notion that everybody serves except the religious Jews in yeshiva happens to be very, very false. If you look in the general society, the people who get out of military service, it is enormous. It is enormous for all sorts of reasons that are much more trivial than people who are seriously studying Torah. All right, so the truth of the matter is, there's no particular reason why we should seize on people of learning as the first way of filling up the army. That's one thing. A second point to consider is that if you are a believer in Torah, believer in God, believer in Torah, you recognize that the success of the Jewish people and the success of Eretz Yisrael is not only a matter of arms, although we need an army, but that the Torah that we learn, the prayers that we offer, the mitzvahs that we do, brings down divine protection on this land. And without that divine protection, Israel is a tiny little country that would certainly be wiped out by the 20 plus nations that are surrounding us. So even in the United States, in the height of Vietnam, I want to remind you, there was a concept that rabbinical students, theological students, were exempt from a mandatory draft. So where does that leave you? I mean, and then that's really kind of the contours of the debate. Well, on one hand, there might be a certain percentage of people who aren't taking yeshiva as seriously as they might. Perhaps some military service would be good. On the other hand, there's certainly a big core of people who are very, very devoted to learning, you know, day and night, and they are part of the spiritual lifeline of Am Yisrael. Now, there's a secondary level of question, and that is, even if we were to agree that the military burden should be spread among a wider group, you then have the issue of creating an environment where soldiers who are religious can live in accordance with fundamental religious principles. Will they be able to daven properly? Will they be able to avoid situations of sexual immodesty, which might be rampant in the army? That's a whole other issue as well. Meaning the army would have to accommodate a Jewish army would have to accommodate religious needs, and that's enormously logistical difficulty. Right now, there are many religious soldiers in the army. First of all, it's important to know that. It's a bit of a myth to say you don't have religious people in the army. You have the Hester yeshivas, which combine learning and military service, but then you have even Haredim, the so-called ultra-Orthodox, who serve in the army, and that's increasing as well. But if you really increase the numbers, the army's going to have major logistical readjustments. And there are a lot of senior generals who are not welcoming an influx of many, many Haredim into the army because they say, number one, they may not make the best soldiers anyway. And number two, there'll be too many demands. You know, they're going to change the kitchens and change, you know, whatever it will be. So this is a very, very painful, painful issue. The issue of not sharing in the sacrifices of the rest of the nation is a painful one, but I would just say that a believer knows that people who are learning Torah are bearing their share of responsibility.
What is the genesis of the problem to begin with? How was it that the Orthodox became the...
Yeah, this is an interesting historical process. You know, in 1948, Ben-Gurion, who was... This is even before the State of Israel. Before he was first prime minister, he was head of the Jewish Agency, which was the provisional government of Palestine to become State of Israel. And he met with the Chazon Ish, who was really the greatest rabbi in Israel at the time. And at that time, there were only 400 yeshiva students in the State of Israel. 400. And Ben-Gurion had a belief that Orthodox Torah Judaism was like a fossil. It would die out, and in a few years, there won't be anyone left. There'll be the new Israeli, strong, secure, confident, not needing this old-fashioned religion. So Ben-Gurion entered an agreement with the Chazon Ish and the Chazon Ish's representatives that people who are full-time Torah students don't have to serve in the army. Ben-Gurion believed at most this would be 500 people, and that would get smaller and smaller and smaller. So it was like a no-brainer for him. Says, get these ultra-Orthodox off my back, I'll give them this little minor concession. Little did he know that Hashem had different plans for the land of Israel. And indeed, the Torah has grown and grown and grown, and it should continue to grow, although there's a lot of work still to be done. Had Ben-Gurion known, he certainly would not have agreed to that exemption at the time, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his hashgacha. But as I say, it is a very, very painful issue. Hester tries to accommodate learning and military service. Hester has its problems. Most of the great Rosh Hashivas have not been in full agreement with it. But I think what's going... Well, okay, I don't want to get into my opinion. I mean, I think what's going to happen is that eventually we're going to see many, many different opportunities. There will be opportunities for full-time learning. There'll be opportunities for part-time military service. There'll be opportunities for full-time, and there'll be opportunities for Sheirut Lumi, which is some type of national service. And I think the Haredi world itself will recognize that different types of boys and men need different types of experiences to form their identity. And for some people, military service might be, or some type of military or Sheirut Lumi might be a very good way of developing skills which can translate into the job market. So I think the problem right now is we're so afraid that our whole way of life is going to be under attack that we're closing the wagons and we're not allowing any type of discussion. But I think in the long run, there's going to be different compromises that are going to be worked out. Yeah?
Okay, so if we just suppose for a minute that the Torah is not of divine authorship,
yeah,
and acknowledge that that doesn't disprove the existence of God, what experiences would we be able to have outside the parameters of Torah that would allow us to arrive at knowledge of God?
Well, once again, I go back a little bit to the intuitive feelings of the soul. I would suggest a few things. Number one, the complexity coupled with the simplicity of the deep structures of the universe, I think, creates a very great, at least intuitive, understanding that there is a supreme coordinating intelligence here. Whether you talk about the God particle, did you read about that? The Higgs boson particle that was discovered. The attempts at the string theory, where you look at different dimensions of reality that are not perceptible by human beings, indicates some deep structures. Einstein, who perhaps, you know, was a person who penetrated into this reality in a very, very deep way, although he was not, Einstein actually didn't believe the Torah came, he didn't believe the Torah came from God, as a matter of fact, but he was absolutely convinced there was a supreme creator and architect of all. Good, now I understand Stephen Hawking disagrees, but you know, like, but Einstein and others did feel that great, great sense of awe in the presence of the amazing realities of the universe. If you read physics today, you almost feel like you're reading Kabbalah. You're not reading science anymore. They're describing all sorts of things that don't make any sense in terms of the reality we're familiar with, and yet they are part and parcel of that reality. I would also suggest, I had mentioned the other week, at least to some of you, that the origin of morality might at least be an inferential proof for the existence of God. For example, Thomas Hobbes in The Leviathan, those of you who are political scientists have come across Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes tried to create what you might call a non-theistic basis for morality. In other words, if you don't believe in God, why be moral? If I don't believe in God, why shouldn't I kill you? Right? If I like your shirt or I like your car or whatever it is. Now, Hobbes, who got in trouble with the Church of England, was kind of an atheist, but Hobbes wanted to argue that there's a basis of morality that does not depend on God. And what he came up with is the instinct of self-preservation. As Hobbes' basic argument was, hey, if I allow myself to kill you because I want your car, then I'm allowing you to kill me to take my car. And since I want to live, it makes sense we enter into a pact of non-aggression where I don't hurt you with the understanding you're not going to hurt me. That was kind of the basis of the Cold War, called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. Neither party would use nuclear bombs because they know the other party will blow them to smithereens as soon as they send the first bomb. So Hobbes' idea was that morality could be grounded in a non-theistic desire for self-preservation. Now, here is where I would add a little bit where that's not always true, because human beings sometimes make moral choices that are not grounded in self-preservation and are actually antagonistic to it. For example, the Gentile who harbors, you went to the Holocaust Museum, Yad Vashem, right? So the Gentile who protects Jews in the Holocaust is not acting out of self-preservation. They're acting out of altruism, out of conscience, out of love for humanity, love for the Jewish people, or maybe just love for humanity in general. Now, the question that you might raise is that's not something that necessarily makes sense from the standpoint of evolutionary biology. If biology moves in the direction of self-preservation, how do you explain altruism, love, self-sacrifice, devotion to causes beyond your immediate needs? I would suggest, at least inferentially, that the source of morality is none other than God himself, who implants within us a desire to do good, a desire to be holy. Now, granted, that desire can be overcome by ego and by id and by other forces, but within us, there is something genuinely good. And that itself, to me, is not a product of biology, because that would almost be counterproductive to biological processes. But I think that's evidence of God. So there are, apart from the Torah itself, I think there are some indicators of a creator who formed us in a certain way. Yeah.
Hey, everyone, please don't judge me. On the issue of bestiality, the Torah says,
We're against it. Yeah.
Do not lie with any animal to be contaminated with it.
Yep.
A woman shall not stand before an animal for mating. It is perversion. Does that mean a man can have sex with an animal, but a woman can't?
No. Reread the two verses again. No. I mean, the short answer is that it's forbidden in both directions. So that much I can assure you. You have to look. You know, again, I don't have all the verses in front of me, but the Torah talks about this in two different places. One, they're both in Leviticus, and also it's a reference in Deuteronomy. So, if you look at all of the verses, I think you'll see that your bases are covered in that in that way. Yeah.
Well, the question might be, why does the Torah have to talk about something that seems to be beyond the pale of...
Well, you know, we hope we're relatively civilized, so, you know, we're not into these things. But, you know, you would be unfortunately very surprised, or maybe not surprised, to understand that many perversions continue to exist in the world. Whether they're pedophilia, but even bestiality, you know, exists in the world. There are websites devoted to them and the like. And we like to think that, you know, we've evolved to some superior moral condition. The truth of the matter is, a lot of the stuff that plagues the ancient world, you know, plagues the modern world. Plus, we have the internet, and we have things added on to. So we still need God's guidance here.
Well, let's specify like a woman meeting for like freaking like. I might have to specify a woman over a man. Like, why isn't it like the same for both? Well, we have to single out women. Women, don't do this.
Well.
Because if the
yeah.
Does, he gets hit.
Yeah, there actually is, the Talmud discusses everything, you know, and people like to make fun of it, but the Talmud believes that God's presence is in the details, the you know, going through the nitty gritty of everything, and it goes through this as well, and the basic idea is that the man prohibition is actually more obvious than the woman prohibition, because the man, as it were, is considered to be an actor. The woman in the sexual act is considered to be acted upon, and the Torah wants to emphasize that even if one is relatively passive in the action, one is not allowed to participate. So there is a special reason to emphasize that. Yeah.
I've heard a lot, pretty often, that like when the Mashiach comes, he's just going to only bring in peace. It's going to be a time of peace for 1,000 years. But then I read in Daniel 12, it says that it seems like to me that it's like, you know, it says at the end of the time. We're going to have like the biggest tribulation in history,
yep.
like the world has ever seen before.
Yep.
I was wondering what your thoughts are on that. Is there going to be like a giant, you know?
Well, here's the thing. You know, the end of the book of Daniel is a very, very difficult, and you know, we don't really know how everything's going to play out. But you are correct. The one thing that emerges from the book of Daniel, as well as from other books of the Bible, is the tremendous turbulence that's going to exist. Not when the Mashiach comes, but before the Mashiach comes. And in the book of Ezekiel, that's given a more specific term. It is called the Wars of Gog and Magog. Daniel doesn't use that particular reference, but that's what he's referring to. In the Talmud, this is called the birth pains of Mashiach. The analogy that it gives is, before a woman gives birth to new life, there's tremendous excruciating labor pains, and the world will go through convulsions. Now, the question becomes, what do we connect that to? Have we had that already? We hope. Was the Holocaust that? You know? Is it the Middle East conflict? Is it the Cold War? You know, it's anybody's guess. The worst case scenario is we haven't seen it yet, which implies we're in for some rough times. There's an enigmatic comment of the Vilna Gaon, which made no sense 250 years ago, but chillingly it makes sense today, that the final war of Gog and Magog will be 9 minutes. Now, 250 years ago, a description of a 9-minute war made no sense at all. Unfortunately, I think all of us understand what a 9-minute war, you know, could mean. So we pray and hope for the best. All I can tell you is we are told there'll be tremendous upheavals, but those upheavals don't have to be the day before Mashiach. In other words, it could be 100 years before Mashiach. Maybe we've had them. Also, I want to point out that in rabbinic tradition, there is a concept that the Chavlei Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach, can be ameliorated or mitigated by repentance and certain good deeds on the part of the Jewish people. In particular, it mentions something that you might think is relatively trivial. It says, if you're careful to have 3 meals on Shabbos, you will be spared from the birth pains of Mashiach. This is actually in the Shabbos Semiras, one of the Semiras of Mechavlei Mashiach, Yitzalu Lirvacha. May we be saved from the birth pains of Mashiach. So we hope that'll happen, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, it's a little bit of a blunt question.
Yeah.
So I believe in God, you know, I'm trying to keep Shabbos, but I find that ripping toilet paper, not being able to touch the temperature on the air conditioner, and the lights being off a little ridiculous. You know, I stub my toe on the bed, I can't touch the air, I'm freezing.
Yeah,
you know, things like this.
I understand.
So, how do you define? Don't you think that we're overanalyzing the Torah to an extreme degree?
Well, listen, it is very true, especially when you're first confronted with this, that the do's and don'ts of Shabbos can be very, very overwhelming, and sometimes it's hard for us to make perfect sense of the whole system. And I want to emphasize 2 points that are contradictory, but both points are true. Point number one is, whatever part of Shabbos you keep is worthwhile and valuable. So if you're doing 50%, that's a good 50%. That's worthwhile, that's good. to be encouraged. There is never an idea that if you're not doing the whole thing, it isn't worth it. That's point one. Point two is there is something special in the whole picture, in which the whole is greater than the sum of the individual parts. You know, if you look at a finely calibrated mechanism, like a computer or whatever it is, you're sending an email, right? So you left out a dot or a dash. The message doesn't go through. You say, well, gee, what difference does it make? I didn't have a dot there. Little things like that. Or, you know, a space mission, you know, might have a 30-cent screw, you know, that's not working, and that destroys, you know, billions of dollars of communications equipment and the like. In finely calibrated exact systems, details are important. And even if the individual detail taken in isolation seems crazy, but as part of a pattern, it might be vital to the whole picture. So, you know, so I understand your feeling. Certainly I understand that. I can tell you, just to give you some comfort, that as you get habituated to these rituals, they become second nature. And maybe that's a downside, actually. But the point basically is you don't have to obsess over them. In other words, they're not in your conscious mind that much. You kind of just readjust your life, and you'll feel better because of it. Yes, sir?
Maybe I'll take one more question.
Yeah.
Okay, this will be the last question.
Last question.
We'll have more time. Everyone will have more time to read it.
If theoretically we live in this world for another 500 years or another 1,000 years past the 6,000 years.
Theoretically, yeah. Okay.
Theoretically, if that happens,
yeah.
Does that disprove Judaism?
No, it absolutely does not. I want to make a point. Although we commonly say, and there are rabbinic sources that say that the world only lasts for 6,000 years, that is not necessarily an authoritative, absolute teaching of Judaism. Maimonides, for example, who describes the process of Mashiach, does not even quote that statement. There are many statements in rabbinic literature that might be the views of individual rabbis, but are not necessarily total. So there is a deep spiritual significance in the 6,000 idea of Mashiach being Shabbos, and it is widely quoted, but Judaism does not stand or fall on a particular year. That much is clear. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, the schedule now is we're going to the bus, we're going home, back to the hotel for dinner, and then optional bike riding around the old city of Jerusalem.
You'll do what? I'll kiss you, man.
I have all the shirim.
Oh, JLE, wait.